For today's message, we're going to be jumping around in Exodus chapters 11 through 13. If you've been following along chronologically, then you know that we discussed the first Passover last week. Of course, it only makes sense from a storytelling perspective that the Passover be intertwined with the story of the final plague of Egypt. However, for the purpose of focusing in on both of these elements independently, we've separated them out. You might find that it would be best to just go ahead and read chapters 11 through 13 in their entirety. If you want to know specifically which verses we're talking about, though, they are all of chapter 11, chapter 12, verses 29 through 30, chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, and chapter 13, verses 11 through 16. So, a grand total of only 20 verses, but they are scattered around everywhere. In those verses, we will find the account of the final plague against Egypt, the death of the firstborn. The final plague was threatened from the beginning of the plagues. In Exodus chapter 4, which we discussed in sermons published on August 6th through the 13th, God ordered Moses, before he even arrived in Egypt, that he should tell Pharaoh, "Thus says Jehovah, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son." Now, we don't have it recorded that Moses passed that message along immediately, but it is fair for us to believe that he did. This means that all the while that these horrible plagues have been falling on Egypt, Pharaoh has known and has been given due warning that it would ultimately end in the death of his son. Chapter 11 picks up in the middle of a tense scene. In chapter 10, Pharaoh had ordered Moses to leave his presence and never see him again, lest he should die. Before Moses left, however, he was given another message from God. "There is a final plague coming, and after it, Pharaoh will drive Moses and the Hebrews out. Not only will he drive them out, but the people of Egypt will be in such fear that they will be paying the people of Israel to leave." The passage indicates that Moses is already highly revered in Egypt, both in the sight of the servants of Pharaoh and of the people. I suppose it is for that reason that he was allowed to keep standing there and speaking out against Pharaoh, in spite of Pharaoh's direct orders to leave. Fear will do that to people. So Moses pronounces the final plague on Egypt. In the middle of the night, every firstborn child in Egypt will die, the son of Pharaoh, the son of the slave, even the sons of the cattle. And Moses said it best, "There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again." The Israelites, however, will have not a single problem. Verse 7 says that there won't even be a dog growling at them, and by this Pharaoh will be able to see that the plague was clearly the work of the divine hand of God bringing about the Hebrews' freedom. And after that, it will be exactly as God said. The people of Egypt will be begging Moses and the Hebrews to go. We are told in verse 8 that Moses was particularly angry when he said this to Pharaoh, and he stormed out of his presence in a rage. As he left, God reminded Moses that Pharaoh would not listen, and that he would not listen because God would glorify himself in his hard-heartedness. Verse 10 reiterates that it was Jehovah who hardened Pharaoh's heart, a topic we discussed in some depth in the August 6th message. In the first half of chapter 12, Moses gives the people of Israel the regulations for the Passover. The second half records the exodus from Egypt itself, which we will discuss next week, and has more Passover regulations. Our only focus from chapter 12 this week is two verses sandwiched in the middle, numbered 29 and 30. They read from the ESV, "At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. I can't even imagine how horrible that must have been. I also want to note, though, the divine nature of it all. The Hebrews could not have done this on their own. They weren't strong enough. Particularly, how could they get into the dungeons and even kill people who were locked away? How could they have known who is there is not a firstborn? Can you look at your neighbor's cow and tell if it was born before the other cows? No disease is so selective. No poison behaves this way. There is no other explanation for this phenomenon than the wrath of an almighty God. In chapter 13, we have two sections to discuss. The first is verses 1 through 2. In those verses, God demands that all the firstborn of Israel, both man and beast, are his. Now, our purpose today is to discuss the plague of death, so I don't want to dig too deeply into this part of the passage. We are going to have more commands relevant to this as we go through the law, so we'll study it more deeply when we get to those passages, but it does suit our purpose to quickly run over the fundamentals of this practice here. We should remember that God had a divine right to kill anyone he wanted. He chose to kill the firstborns, and he was merciful to the firstborn of Israel. As such, he will now make a special demand that all the firstborns be devoted to him. Moses gives a descriptor of this in verses 11 through 16. The essential principle of this passage is that the firstborn of everything, both sons and livestock, belong to God because he spared them from a deserved death. As such, those firstborn creatures must be given to God. Now, the things, obviously, were not given to God directly. They were instead given to God's priests at the tabernacle or the temple. And at this point in the Exodus, those things don't exist yet, so the passage doesn't explicitly say that's what happens, but we know that it is. The animals given to the priests were used to make sacrifices and to provide for the upkeep of God's things and his priests. Now, the tabernacle doesn't need all of the firstborn sons to keep it running. So, as we see in verses 13 and 15, those sons are redeemed, meaning that they are brought to and devoted to God, and are then purchased back out of God's ownership. So, God takes the sons, the people redeem the sons for money, they can have their sons back, God gets the money, and everyone wins. Evidently, donkeys are not of much value to the tabernacle either. A donkey is to be purchased back for the redemption price of one lamb, which is much more edible and more useful for sacrifices. All of this, we note, is to be a symbol for generations to come, reminding them that Jehovah brought the Israelites out of Egypt with a mighty hand, delivering their firstborn and killing the Egyptian firstborn. This command about devoting the firstborn things was so important to God that he insisted it should be as a mark on the hand or a frontlet between the eyes. A frontlet, if you don't know, is basically an ornamental headband. The point here is that this should be something you can't forget. It is written on your hand, you know it is there. If it is stuck on your forehead, you know it is there. So God insists that his people not forget this. So that's the brief rundown of the redemption of these firstborns. We will see it again in the Torah, so file it away in your mind. I think that the first lesson we should learn from our passage today is that our sins affect other people. In this story, we see that Pharaoh's sins have greatly harmed the people of Egypt. Pharaoh is the one making the decision not to let the people go, and as a result, children die across all of Egypt. This is a severe pain for all the people who survive, and also for those who didn't. This has largely been the nature of all the plagues. Pharaoh alone holds on to his pride, and with every passing day, the people of Egypt become poorer, sicker, and more miserable. Often, people have a tendency to think that their sins won't hurt anybody. They'll justify a lie as being just a little one, without realizing that a small lie erodes the trust in their relationships. And it doesn't only erode trust in their immediate relationships. A person who is less trusting in one relationship will become less trusting in their other relationships as well, because they learn not to trust. Some people will try to keep their secret sins private, thinking that it won't hurt anyone, because it's just something that only they know about. What these fail to realize, though, is that any behavior in a person's life has at least some small impact on their psychology, their personality, and their other behaviors. It matters when you sin in private, because whether you like it or not, you matter to someone in society, and even if that someone can't see your sin, they will see you, and you will be changed. And how is it that people plan to cover their secret sins up? Will they have to lie to their loved ones? Will they have to shut down openness in their relationships? How will hiding the secret sin affect the people you love? And what will happen when the sin is found out? How disappointed will the people around you be? Perhaps there is some young person who makes a hero of you and who strives to be like you. Will that person still want to be a hero when he finds out that his heroes weren't what he thought they would be? Of course, all of that is to say nothing of the more overt and less hidden sins. These sins are clearly detrimental to someone else. I will tell you a story about a sin that was done to me once. While I was away, thieves broke into my house and stole from me. The thing they stole was copper wires. The price of copper was high at the time, but all the wires that they stole put together couldn't have fetched them more than $20. That theft, however, cost me thousands. Cut wires would be scrapped for pennies, but new wires were expensive, and the skilled technical labor required to install those wires into my home's electrical system cost a great deal. While my family was working to have the damage repaired, we went for an extended period of time without electricity, significantly decreasing the value of our lives. I wished often during that period that the thief had simply come to my door, knocked, and said, "Hey, would you mind giving me $20? He might have convinced me to do it without all the trouble. I tell that story because it demonstrates an important thing about sin. Sin hurts more than it helps. The sin that you want to commit may be tantalizing. It beckons you, you crave it, you think that you can't live without it. But when you have it, the damage that it causes is always significantly worse than whatever benefit it may bestow. And that damage won't always be dealt to the person who commits the sin. The thief may very well get away with the theft. He gains, but the other person loses significantly. The rapist might escape. He enjoys himself for a few minutes, but he leaves behind a person robbed of a most valuable possession. The gossip will likely never be punished for gossiping, and telling his tales takes a weight off his chest and gives him a fun time with his friend, but the victim of the gossip has his reputation destroyed. The drug dealer makes a quick buck, but his product ruins the life of his customer. In each case, a person does something that he believes is in his own best interest, but he does so at the expense of a weaker person, and the amount that the victim pays is greater than what the sinner gains. This is no win-win. Sin causes problems. The sinner often thinks that he wins out in that arrangement, but does he? He is slightly richer than he was before, but the people in his community are significantly poorer than they once were. Is it truly worthwhile to gain just a little and to cause a net loss to all of society? The answer to that clearly is no. Because if everyone begins to live that way, then soon the society will begin to spiral downward. Victims will become desperate. They will think that there is more penalty in doing right than there is in doing wrong, and they will begin to think that breaking the rules is the only way to level the playing field in a crooked game. Does anyone want to live in a society like that? Do you want to live in a world where you can't trust your neighbor? Where everyone you know is looking out only for himself and himself alone? Do you want to be a member of a society in which everyone is fighting for the scraps that remain after all of the best things in life have been callously and wastefully destroyed? I don't think you do. Sometimes I fear that we are going to exactly that place in America today. Thankfully, each of us can do something to turn that plight around. You see, listener, you can be the one who refuses to sin, who stands up for what is right, and who does what is in the best interest instead of only your personal interest. That won't be an easy life to live in a culture that is spiraling downward. You will probably find, until that spiral reverses, that you are the person over whom everyone else takes advantage, but you will never get the benefit of taking advantage of anyone else. Be that person who decides to turn the tide anyway. I want to note that all of these principles are magnified when they are applied to those who have power in society. Some of us can do less to change the world than others can. An employee on the bottom rung has little impact on the culture at work, but a wealthy business executive can change the lives of everyone below him. One member of a church will not make as much difference as the leading elders who have an impact on everyone. The word of the cable news editor counts for more than that of the fellow who writes one little blog post. And of course, as in this case, the political and military leaders like Pharaoh, who have sway over the people of an entire geographic region, can have a tremendous impact. It should serve as a warning to us that those who are in positions of authority have greater responsibility, and that those of us who have power to appoint leaders must choose wisely. I am reminded of an event that took place not much over a year before I write, which I found to be most disheartening. Some of you will remember it. There was a young man who was widely respected in Christian circles, largely because of the respect that his father drew. He was made the director for a major Christian and family organization that was aggressively campaigning and lobbying ahead of the Supreme Court's decision regarding gay marriage in 2015. On the day that he was appointed, I said to my wife, "You watch. He was appointed because of who his father is, and because they trust his father, they did not do the work of properly vetting him." Unfortunately, I was found to be right in that case. About 2 years after this young man was appointed to his position, in 2015, the crucial year, it was revealed that he had been involved in molesting a number of young girls in prior years. A few months after that, it was discovered that he had been committing adultery behind his wife's back. He put out a statement in which he admitted to it and said, "While publicly stating I was fighting against immorality in our country, I was hiding my own personal failures." Of course, between the first revelation about him and the second one, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to enforce homosexual marriage all across the United States as the law of the land. That was a pivotal moment for a lot of people, and I think that the unfortunate revelations about the young man had made it all the worse. Honestly, I sometimes wonder if the justices didn't take it all into consideration when they made their decision. Here, the fellow who had been lecturing them all about sexual morals had been involved in sexual immorality himself. And at a time when Christianity was taking a severe beating, a time when we desperately needed good leaders and a good face in the media, the person who had been best poised to do the job was having us all decried as hypocrites and perverts, worse than the people we opposed. This was the case of one man who had a little secret sin. He thought it wouldn't hurt anyone. He thought that no one would ever know about it. he had gained virtually nothing, and a lot of other people lost a lot. He did too. Sin is like that. So we must always be careful to avoid sin. We must be careful about who we appoint as leaders. And for those of us who have great responsibilities, we must live up to them. It is not just sins of commission that will hurt you. When I say sins of commission, I mean positive acts. I am referring to a sin which you commit. I'm referring to a sin in which you do something you shouldn't do. Murder is a sin of commission. Stealing is a sin of commission. Adultery is a sin of commission. The partner to sins of commission are sins of omission. Those are sins in which you fail to do that which you ought to do. Omission is the neutral act of doing nothing when you should be doing something. Often in society today, sins of omission are overlooked, but they can be just as detrimental as their counterpart. An example might be that your friend is drunk and is about to get into a car. You watch him go and omit to stop him. You failed to do your duty because it would be uncomfortable for you to bother your friend. Then he crashes his car. There is incredible damage, and maybe someone even dies or spends the rest of his life disfigured. Such a thing is a sin of omission. You gained a little bit of comfort by failing to do something you should have done, and as a result, other innocent people lost much more than you gained. And the people of Egypt were not harmed only by the actions of Pharaoh. They were also harmed by their own inaction. We've been studying Exodus for 17 weeks now. Go back through those sermons and find for me the example of the Egyptian people doing something to help the Hebrews or have them set free. The one and only instance you will find is in Exodus chapter 10, verse 7. In that verse, some of the officials push back against Pharaoh and convince him to negotiate with Moses. That's it. One time they ask him to negotiate, and they only do it after Egypt has fallen into ruin. Folks, if the people of Egypt knew that all these plagues were coming and had only come because Pharaoh was refusing to let the Hebrews go, they should have done something to let the Hebrews go. And listen to me when I say this, because it is true. No one in history has kept a million people in bondage by himself. There are always those people who will turn a blind eye to abuse, who will follow orders, who will go along to get along, and who will just do their job and ignore the consequences. Pharaoh didn't enslave all those people alone, and he couldn't keep them enslaved on his own, any more than Hitler killed all those Jews in Europe on his own, or any more than the American presidents threw an embarrassingly large portion of their population into prisons on their own. These kinds of things don't happen because one person at the top makes a bad decision. They happen because one person at the top makes a bad decision, the people in their immediate sphere or influence help them, and none of the masses does anything to stop them. If all of the slave masters in Egypt had thrown down their whips and told the Hebrews to get out of Egypt on the day that the Nile turned to blood, they would have all come out of this thing with their firstborn children still living. But they didn't. They watched it get worse and worse and worse, and every time that it did, they kept on accepting their pay and saying, "Hey, it's not my responsibility, it's someone else's job." It doesn't always take some Herculean effort to make people slaves and ruin their lives. Sometimes it just takes a whole bunch of people who are following the path of least resistance. And that is why, dear friend, It is so important for you to stand up and push back when you see something that is wrong. Of course, we should also remember that the people of Egypt have had a lot of serious guilt on their heads for a long time. We would fail terribly if we neglected to mention the heinous sin that started all of this. Some 80 years prior, the Egyptians had worked hand in hand to kill all the sons of the Hebrews, and surely killed thousands and thousands of innocents in the process. The punishment that has come upon them is a balanced retribution. It is an eye for an eye, a firstborn for a firstborn. Justice may be unseen for a while, but eventually it comes, and the people of Egypt have finally gotten the punishment they deserved all along. Now, some will posit, no doubt, that God was unjust in this matter. They will have what appears to be a good reason. They will say, God should not punish the son for his father's sins, and he should not punish the firstborn children of Egypt, particularly not the young ones, for sins which were committed by their fathers a generation ago. Surely a small Egyptian child is not to be considered guilty. Of course, anyone who thinks that a small child is innocent has not ever raised a small child. The reality is that children are sinners just like everyone else. We are all born sinners, and we are all in God's hands to do with us as he pleases. The passage very clearly supports this. Remember, even the Hebrews, the ones who were wrongly enslaved, who were brutally mistreated, and whose children were subjected to genocide, even they deserved to die in a final plague of Egypt. And if they had failed to observe the Passover, they would have died. Sin is everywhere. Everyone is saddled with sin, and everyone deserves death for it. We should not look at death and say, why did this man deserve to die? Rather, we should look at life and ask, why does God allow any man to live? It is only for his love and his mercy that we are allowed to live. So do not cry out that there was an injustice done in Egypt. Everyone deserves the wrath of God. And of course, as we discussed last week, the good news is that there is a way to avoid our deserved wrath. And that way is by the blood of Jesus, our sacrificial lamb, and the ultimate firstborn son. So then, in conclusion, we have finally reached the end of the plagues of Egypt, and the final plague has been worse than all that came before it. The firstborn sons of Egypt are dead, but God's people have been protected by the blood of the Lamb. The catastrophe that came upon Egypt demonstrates to us that sin has deadly consequences, not only for ourselves, but also for the people around us as well. Sin is alluring, but it comes at a much higher price than it is worth. Next week, the Exodus from Egypt. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.